Good evening. It's that time once again for the weekly edition of Mindscapes. This is Corey Dunkirk, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer. On tonight's show, I'll be reading from the magazines The Science of Longevity and Psychology Today. The first group of articles will be from The Science of Longevity, the first piece by Stacy Baker, titled The Benefits of Alternative Medicine. Complementary modalities like acupuncture, Reiki, and naturopathy help prevent illnesses that cut lives short. Advances in modern medicine have contributed much to Americans' longevity, but new research into the various modalities of alternative medicine has shown that they can complement Western medical practices and contribute to a longer, healthier lifespan. Here's a look at how six of the most popular therapies can help you stay healthy and pain-free longer. Chiropractic. The theory behind chiropractic is that structure affects function, says Gabrielle Francis, a New York-based naturopath, chiropractor, and acupuncturist. Therefore, by aligning the spine, a patient improves the function of the nervous system, immune system, and lymphatics, and the musculoskeletal system. Francis says this prevents degeneration of ligaments and discs that lead to arthritis, disc disease, and chronic pain. And the more flexibility you have in your spine, muscles, and joints, the more you're able to live a pain-free life, stay active, and reap the benefits of exercise. Acupuncture. Numerous studies have shown that acupuncture helps relieve both short-term and chronic pain, as well as inflammation. An acupuncturist will insert small stainless steel needles into acupuncture points, or energy points, in the body to balance your qi. Qi is a vital life force of the body, explains Francis. Think of it as gas in a tank. Keeping gas in the tank makes a car run well for the cross-country trip, not just for looking good in the driveway. Acupuncture puts your brain in the alpha state of brainwave patterning, which resets your nervous system. The alpha state allows your entire body to rest so your batteries recharge, explains Francis. Acupuncture also helps your body produce the happiness neurotransmitters, endorphins, serotonin, and dopamine. Plus, it lowers the stress level cortisol, which leads to anxiety, depression, diabetes, osteoporosis, and obesity, all of which can impact your lifespan. Naturopathy. Naturopathic medicine takes a whole person approach, body, mind, spirit, and includes herbal medicine, nutrition and diet therapies, homeopathic medicine, physical medicine, and body-mind therapies. The good news is you don't need to choose between a naturopathic and a medical doctor. You can consult both, says Francis. A naturopathic doctor can give you a personalized lifestyle plan and a diet and health regime of herbs and supplements that can complement Western protocols, she says. Another big difference between the two modalities? Naturopathic medicine emphasizes preventative measures, while a medical doctor usually only steps in once you have a problem. Massage. Massage doesn't just make you feel amazing. It actually makes you healthier and promotes anti-aging. Massage increases circulation, strengthens your immune system, relaxes your muscles, and improves flexibility, says Francis. It also oxygenates the blood and lowers cortisol. It's linked to better sleep, lower blood pressure, and less inflammation, which can help ward off many age-related disorders. Chinese medicine. Chinese medicine includes therapies like acupuncture, Chinese herbs, cupping, and moxibustion, the burning of herbs over acupuncture points, which is believed to increase qi. Chinese herbs, particularly those that target hormone balancing and adrenal tonifying, such as spleen and kidney qi formulas, have a role in promoting longevity, says Francis. Chinese herbs can be used for any dysfunction, as they have powerful pharmaceutical effects, she says. They can boost immunity, increase energy levels, and improve sleep. One note of caution, Chinese herbs may conflict with Western meds, and it may be dangerous to mix the two unless you have a very well-trained Chinese herbalist and medical doctor communicating with each other. Reiki. With this therapy, energy is channeled through a practitioner's hands to a patient's body to provide holistic healing. The idea is to reduce anxiety, lessen pain, release emotional blockages, increase energetic flow and qi, and support overall healing and well-being. While research is limited, two UCLA health studies showed that stressed-out lab rats who received Reiki treatments had a significant reduction in anxiety, stress, and depression. Several universities and hospitals, including UCLA Health and New York Presbyterian Hospital, incorporate the practice into their treatment programs. This is a piece by Stacy Baker titled "The Benefits of Alternative Medicine." Next is a piece by Janine Detz titled "Surprising Keys to a Healthy Retirement." Playing golf and watching Wheel of Fortune are no longer the only retirement options. In fact, your post-work life is the ideal time to focus on wellness of body, mind, and spirit. When Nancy and Jeff retired a couple of years ago, they wanted to make fitness, which had long been put on the back burner during their busy working days, a priority. Jeff now plays tennis almost every day, and Nancy hits the court several times a week. They also started going to the gym regularly, where they both do strength training. Jeff is studying Spanish and doing language immersion, going to Spanish-speaking countries and living with families for a month to practice his Español. He most recently went to Guatemala. Nancy is taking advanced short story writing classes, and they both belong to book clubs. If that weren't enough, they also are avid theater goers, and Nancy loves going to live music shows as well. They travel frequently too, most recently visiting France and Portugal. Up next, a trip to Cuba later this year. Harry and Leela decided to retire in Sedona, Arizona about 20 years ago after a single visit. They fell in love with the area's natural beauty, climate, and artistic vibe. Since then, they've done tons of hiking together in the nearby hills. Harry plays tennis regularly, and they both work out at the community gym. Leela revived her interest in violin and began playing with a local symphony. She also started a business with a couple of friends that provides music at weddings and parties. This is not your grandparents' retirement. One of the keys to living longer is taking steps to ensure your retirement years are fun, fulfilling, and healthy. Here are expert tips for making them your true golden years. Find your purpose. Your goal? ID an activity you can and will do regularly. It should be something that you can look forward to and that fits your unique talents and interests, says Chris Ludwigsen, PhD, a clinical psychologist who had been retired for 11 years. According to a study published in the journal Psychological Science, people with a sense of purpose had a 15% lower risk of dying during the next 14 years than those who felt they didn't have a direction. Feeling a little lost? Ludwigsen suggests taking a cue from your post-college career search. The book, What Color is Your Parachute?, can help you identify the things that are important to you, and the quiz at viacharacter.org can home in on your values. Use the intel to find a volunteer opportunity, hobby club, or even a new job that might bring you fulfillment. Choose a next-level hobby. Any pastime will keep your mind active, but more complicated activities provide the biggest brain boost. Research from the University of Texas at Dallas found that 80 to 90-year-olds who practiced a complex skill, such as quilting, significantly improved their memory over a 3-month period compared to older adults who had used the time to work on tasks with fewer steps. Going back to school. Learning spurs new connections between neurons in your brain. Many online and brick-and-mortar colleges offer free or discontinued tuition to seniors, but formal education isn't the only option. Your local community center and library likely offer classes as well. Not sure what to study? Try a foreign language. Studies link speaking two or more languages, even if you learned the second one as an adult, to slower age-related declines in cognitive function, which may explain why bilingual people have a later onset of dementia. Hire an expert. Retirement coaches are counselors who specialize in this life stage. We help clients figure out where to live, how to spend their time, how to maintain a life with meaning, and how to continue growing, says Sarah Zeff Geber, PhD, a certified retirement coach and author of the book Essential Retirement Planning for Solo Agers. Some retirement coaches also help their clients prepare for the physical changes that come with aging. To find a counselor in your area, go to retirementcoachesassociation.org. Retirement Coaches Association is all one word. Set long-term goals. Think about where you see yourself in 1, 2, or 5 years and make a plan for getting there. Research shows that setting goals provides motivation and gives you a sense of accomplishment and empowerment. To be successful, use the SMART formula. Create goals that are specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. For example, instead of aiming to lose weight, Your goals might be to walk every morning and cook 5 healthy dinners a week starting next Sunday. Believe you'll get better. Health setbacks, from a minor sprain to a chronic disease, unfortunately become more common as you age. But a positive outlook may improve your odds of recovery. Research published in the Journal of American Medical Association found that people over the age of 70 who believed they'd get better were 44% more likely to recover from a severe disability than those who had a glass-half-empty outlook. Start a side hustle. Retiring doesn't have to mean the end of working. In fact, many people are using the time to switch to a new job or pick up a new part-time gig. Think of what you love to do and how to capitalize on it. Some ideas? Turn your love of dogs into a pet-sitting business, or sell your garage sale scores on eBay. Stick to a schedule. When you work, you're accountable to someone. A schedule can create a similar feeling of accountability, says Ludwigson. Plus, it forces you to get up and going. Go big. If you've always wanted to travel to the Galapagos Islands or write your memoir, there's truly no time like the present. The freedom of retirement makes it the ideal time to finally follow your biggest dreams. Need some inspiration? Frank McCourt's best-selling and first novel, Angela's Ashes, was published when he was 66, and the late Gladys Burrell ran her first marathon at age 86. Think of retirement as the ultimate opportunity to do something amazing. Join the club. Meeting with people who have similar interests can improve your mental and physical health. A club can also give you something to look forward to each week or month, says Ludwigson. Consider groups centered around a hobby, like books, knitting, gardening, or art, or professional organizations. My county psychological association has a get-together every month, says Ludwigson. It's a nice way of keeping in touch with someone from my profession. Change your tune. Simply listening to music can improve your mood, but singing may provide an additional lift. One study found that after 3 months, people who participated in a choral group felt less depressed and anxious. If you enjoy performing, join a church choir or audition for a local master choral. But even if the shower has been your only singing stage, there's a vocal outlet for you. Nationwide, people are gathering in homes, coffee shops, and community centers to belt out tunes en masse. Find an informal sing-along by searching for group singing at meetup.com. Work for free. The mental perks of helping others are well known, but volunteering may give you a physical edge too. According to research at Carnegie Mellon University, adults over the age of 50 who volunteered on a regular basis, 200 hours in a year, were less likely to develop high blood pressure than people who didn't volunteer. Check out volunteermatch.org to find short and long-term opportunities near you. Look on the bright side. Yes, getting older has its drawbacks, but there are positives too. Retirement brings new options and freedom, says Ludwigson. Focusing on the good things about aging will make you feel happier and can also improve your health. A study by researchers in Ireland found that a positive attitude can help prevent older adults from becoming frail and may result in better cognitive abilities in the years that follow. If you have just joined us or you've recently tuned in, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona for the blind and visually impaired, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year from over 200 publications. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer, Corey Dunkirk, reading from the magazines The Science of Longevity and Psychology Today on the program Mindscapes. Moving on now to Psychology Today. The first piece is by Abigail Fagan, titled When to Be Selfish. When making joint decisions, choosing a movie to watch with your spouse or a restaurant to visit with a friend, should you push for what you want or put your preferences aside to please your companion? Researchers asked study participants to watch videos such as clips of Saturday Night Live and rate how much they enjoyed each one. They also completed surveys to measure how naturally selfish or altruistic they were. 2 weeks later, the same participants were divided into pairs and instructed to pick one video to watch. Pairs of more selfish or more altruistic individuals chose videos that were farther from what they preferred than pairs of ones more selfish and one more altruistic individual. Why? People with similar temperaments begin to negotiate, says author Michael Lowe of Georgia Tech. Two selfless people offer suggestions they wrongly think the other prefers. Two selfish people won't accept the other's initial offer. They'll select an item neither want but both can tolerate. Couples may want to take turns being the more selfish one when making decisions. That strategy has proved successful in Lowe's relationship. he and his wife always struggled with where to go for dinner. We both tried to let the other person pick. We found out that we actually wanted to go to the same place, but we both were trying to be nice about it, Lowe says. Now we make each other be honest. I say, you pick tonight. What do you want? It's going well. Next is a piece by Elliot D. Cohen, Ph.D., titled Perfect in Bed. Demanding sexual perfection can destroy your sex life. For many people, sex needs to be perfect. Of course, this notion leads to real anxiety, before sex, during sex, after sex. And anxiety can spoil the experience. People worry about poor execution and, as a result, bring about precisely what they fear. After all, if it's anything less than perfect, then that's not what it should be, right? In fact, the answer is no. More precisely, sexual perfectionism may involve any or all of the following demands. Must have an orgasm. Must have good timing. Reaching orgasm neither prematurely nor too late. Must satisfy my partner. For men, must be able to have and maintain my erection. For women, must be aroused and lubricated. My partner must approve of my body. If you make any of these demands, then you probably suffer from such perfectionism, a self-defeating form of thought. Demanding perfection. I'm not telling you to surrender your high sexual standards. It's not your idealism. Sex can be so wonderful. That's creating your self-defeating anxiety. Indeed, sex can range from no orgasm whatsoever to indescribable ecstasy, an experience that can mean utter elation when bodies coalesce and resonate like one well-rounded clock, but can also suffer from poor timing. Of course, you don't prefer the dysphoria of the latter, and you don't want sex to be just okay. Euphoric sex is not an unreasonable ideal, but there is a fundamental difference between an aspiration and a requirement. It's reasonable to aspire to have perfect sex, but it's unrealistic to demand that you be perfect every time, because this is impossible or damn near it. Instead, you can keep working to improve your performance. How liberating! You are not going to turn into a pumpkin if you mess up. You can, in fact, learn something new, something you can use in successive experiences. You can always improve, and that's what's exciting about giving up perfectionism. Relinquishing this mindset will set you free to explore, to try new things, and to get excited about your relationship without worrying and ruminating. The first step in overcoming this type of thinking is being self-aware. The next step is working cognitively, behaviorally, and emotionally to relinquish your self-defeating demands for magnificence. If you demand sexual flawlessness, you likely exhibit this type of fault-finding in other aspects of your life, such as work or school. Addressing these tendencies outside of the bedroom will help you inside of the bedroom. Here are a few of the types of perfectionism that may lead people to sexual perfectionism: achievement, approval, certainty, control, ego-centered, existential, moral, and neatness. If you are an approval perfectionist, for example, you'll worry about whether you will win the praise of others, including your partner. A certainty perfectionist, meanwhile, ruminates about the possibility of messing up all areas in life, as well as sexual performance. If you're a control perfectionist, you'll experience anxiety when you think you can't control what happens in your life, including what happens in the bedroom. It's a good idea to give up these various types of demands, but not your aspiration to be excellent at what you do. Again, it isn't your high aspirations that create the problems, it's your demand that you achieve them. Sage advice. Here is some advice from the Buddha, Socrates, Epictetus, Kant, and Nietzsche, among others, for working toward overcoming your predispositions. According to Buddhism, reality is impermanent, and suffering occurs when you demand that reality be other than it is. The plain truth is that there is no certainty that you will perform the way you want or prefer. Let go of your demand for certainty. Once you do, you are free to resonate with reality, instead of experiencing anxiety over it. Your body is never going to be perfect, and it is ever-changing. As Socrates would admonish, stop demanding bodily perfection, looking for flaws and ruminating about appearance. Once you give up this unrealistic demand about physical reality, you are free to enjoy your body rather than getting bogged down berating it. The wise Stoic philosopher Epictetus would remind you that you cannot control how others view you or your body, but you can control how you view yourself and the world. Stop demanding what is not yours to demand, namely whether your partner will approve of you or your body. Instead, direct your attention to enjoying your sexual experience. You are not your orgasm. If you don't have an orgasm or an erection, that doesn't mean that you are a failure. Separate your self-worth from what happens during intimacy. To paraphrase the philosopher Immanuel Kant, your worthiness as a person remains intact and is not diminished by how well you do in bed. This is a piece by Elliot D. Cohen, Ph.D., titled Perfect in Bed. Next is an article by Jennifer Latson titled The Intimidation Factor. It can be daunting to encounter people who are physically formidable, ultra-rich, super-smart, or generally high-powered. But there are ways to manage such interactions with grace and confidence, whether you're the intimidator or the one who just wants to get away. When he ran into an injured hiker on a remote mountain trail, Bill Stratton just wanted to help. He'd come around a bend to find two young women, one of whom had hurt her leg so badly she couldn't walk. Stratton, a poet who teaches writing at State University of New York's Plattsburgh campus, happens to be trained in wilderness rescue. He's also 6'5" and 250 pounds, with a booming voice and abundant facial hair that, on winter hikes, tends to frost over into what he describes as an ice beard. It can make him a startling figure in the woods. "Hi, my name is Bill, and I know first aid. Can I help?" he asked the women. Hoping to project non-threatening helpfulness, he smiled, kept his hands in his pockets, and remained at a distance. But he could see the fear in their faces. The standing woman immediately yelped, "No!" The injured woman took longer to respond, as though thinking of the right words to get rid of him. "I'm waiting for a helicopter," she finally said. Stratton knew there was no helicopter on the way, but he also knew that saying so and sticking around would only make the pair more uncomfortable. So he hiked on and eventually came across a ranger who headed up to help. The women got off the mountain safely, but it bothered Stratton to know that they had counted him among the dangers they faced that day. "I was doing everything I could think of not to be intimidating," he says. "I hate that's how I'm perceived, and it happens a lot." Intimidation plays a role in our social interactions every day. Some people present as physically intimidating, others are imposing because of their personality, intellect, wealth, or social status. Still others may remind us of someone who spooked us in the past. Whatever the source, we rarely discuss it openly, so the people who intimidate us often have no idea how we see them. That can carry real risks, since the feeling of being intimidated can trigger a fight-or-flight response just as any other perceived threat does. People who are easily intimidated, especially those for whom self-esteem is a challenge, may find their behavior changing for reasons that they don't realize. And even the most seemingly secure individuals get intimidated sometimes, though not always by whom you'd expect. Big misunderstanding. The fact that Jason Pena is built like a linebacker was a clear asset on his high school football team. It also helped him become a bouncer at the Houston Bar, where he now works as a bartender and manager. But he rarely throws his weight around. Friends describe him as a softy, and coworkers call him Peanut. As a bouncer, he's always tried to avoid physical confrontation. But while his size alone often persuades potential troublemakers to get in line, it can occasionally provoke a violent response. "Some people see a big guy and want to prove themselves," Pena says, "especially if they've been drinking." Stratton, who also worked as a bouncer for several years, says his size was more of a liability than an advantage on the job. "He took at least 20 punches over the course of his bouncing career," he says. One patron broke a pool cue over his head. The intimidating effect of physical size is one of the easiest to explain from an evolutionary perspective. People bigger than we are pose an obvious threat. They could hurt us. It's basic mammalian stuff, says psychiatrist Grant Brenner. These nonverbal cues signal things that we pick up outside of consciousness and influence the way we perceive the other person and interpret their intentions. We may therefore be ready to fight an intimidating person before we understand why. And those of us who've unintentionally intimidated someone may be surprised when that person throws a punch or runs away. Stratton would prefer they do neither, especially when it's someone with whom he aspires to form a relationship. "I never want to intimidate people when I'm teaching or at a faculty meeting or talking to the parents of my kids' classmates," he says. "I would say most poets and writers aren't the most social people, but I am social, I'm friendly, and I like meeting people. But I can see it come across people's faces. They'll tell me later, 'When I first met you, I was intimidated and nervous.' I'm like, 'Why? What was I doing? How can I not do it again?'" For tall people, one answer could be to make themselves seem shorter. But it's not as simple as crouching down or hunching over, which can appear condescending. Crouching also forces people into a closed posture that comes across as unfriendly, Brenner explains. It looks a lot like looming. The tall people I know who put people at ease find a way to lower themselves without being obvious about it, he says. Some, for example, simply widen their stance, which makes them seem a few inches shorter. Stratton's preferred approach is to stay seated as much as possible, but he's still seeking a better way to convey that he's not a threat. My mom once got me a shirt that says, "Sometimes I pee when I laugh." That's about the least intimidating shirt I could think of, Stratton says, adding that he'd wear it all the time if it meant he'd elicit whatever is the normal response to meeting a person. Why we retreat. Even giants aren't immune to intimidation. When I'm intimidated, it's almost never about size or loudness. Sometimes it's just about the stakes, Stratton says, such as when he interviews for a job. But I know that feeling, and it's terrible. Feeling intimidated typically boils down to a sense that the person you're interacting with is more powerful than you. Socially powerful people, for example, could be wealthy, attractive, intelligent, talented, or even just incredibly charming. Because these qualities are valued by others, they elevate the people possessing them to a higher perceived social status. Then there are those who occupy a position of power, either absolute or relative to you, such as a police officer pulling you over for speeding. One way we react to these power differences is by deferring to people in higher positions, trying to please them and do what they say. But we don't have to be afraid of someone to have this reaction, according to psychologist Jessica Tracy, director of the University of British Columbia's Emotion and Self Lab. We also showed deference to powerful people we respect and admire, she says, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing. Our instinct to follow people with higher social status is one of the ways we and other primates have succeeded in creating stable social structures that benefit the group as a whole. Humans also have a fundamental desire for social inclusion. Studies show that we feel rejection in much the same way as we do physical pain. Since people with high status have an outsized influence on our social networks, their position represents another way they could hurt us. They could ostracize you or turn others against you if they decide they don't like you. They could cut you out of important group decisions, says Joseph Marks, a PhD candidate in experimental psychology at University College London and the co-author of the book Messengers, Who We Listen To, Who We Don't, and Why. But if you have a strong alliance with them, the reverse could be true. So you're motivated to look for ways to win them over. We don't even have to know a person well to admire or fear them. Status symbols alone are enough to sway our behavior. You form stereotypes from a tiny piece of information, like what car they drive or what job they have, says Marx. Status signals. One early study of how socioeconomic status inspires deference, conducted in the 1960s, measured the amount of time it took California drivers to honk at a car that didn't move when a traffic light turned green. In surveys, most people said they'd honk just as fast no matter what make of car they were stuck behind. In reality, drivers gave high-end cars significantly more leeway. Drivers took much less time to honk at a scruffy old sedan than at a shiny new Chrysler, Marx says. We defer to higher status without realizing it. We've evolved to be lightning-quick judges of where others stand in the social hierarchy. Sometimes the signifiers are obvious, like driving a Bentley. But we all signal status in the way we talk, act, and carry ourselves, and these nonverbal cues are surprisingly effective at conveying social rank. There's research to suggest that some of these are universal, that people see certain signals for higher rank across different cultures, Tracy says. That includes what researchers call expansive postural displays, such as puffing your chest out, putting your hands on your hips, and otherwise occupying more physical space. These gestures do tend to accurately reflect higher status, Tracy says. Think of man-spreading, or of the executive who leans back and puts his arms behind his head at a meeting and takes up a lot of space. That's a very dominant gesture. Even small gestures can make a big difference in how we're perceived. A 2013 study found that people were judged more intimidating when they just tilted their faces slightly either upward or downward. Tilting in either direction makes our faces look wider, the researchers noted, and wider faces correlate with higher testosterone levels and greater aggression. We understand this effect, even if we aren't consciously aware when we do it. Participants in the study also spontaneously tilted their faces when they were told to try to look intimidating. Staring is another powerful intimidator. A sustained, direct gaze tends to elicit strong fight-or-flight reactions. A 2017 study found that people with lower social status were more likely to avoid someone who was staring, while people with higher status tended to approach and confront the onlooker. In a 2016 study, Tracy and her colleagues found that deep, low-pitched voices are perceived as a sign of dominance and leadership capacity across cultures. Further, they observed that we modify the pitch of our own voices depending on whether we outrank the person we're talking to in terms of social status. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations in which we want or need to create a more intimidating impression, so we can use these techniques intentionally. But Tracy warns that this can backfire if we can't back up the vibes we try to give off. These subtle cues can have a huge impact on how others perceive you, but they can be risky because people could see you negatively if they feel you don't deserve the power you project, she says. You have to know the context and know your audience. A force for good. Patricia Mango didn't give her former job as a New York State Supreme Court justice or her current role as one of three judges on the courtroom TV show Hot Bench by being meek. On the show, her audience includes the 3 million people who tune in daily to watch her argue verdicts with her tribunal. In court, however, she adapts her performance for a much smaller audience, the defendants. When she comes across as tough-talking and iron-willed, it's a deliberate choice. She's trying to harness the power of intimidation for good. "I am different as Patricia than I am as Judge Domingo," she says. "I often won't tell people I'm a judge because that title in itself is intimidating. In my personal life, I want to be pleasant, I want to make friends. But when I'm on the bench, I need to portray a person who has credibility and consistency, a certain amount of power, and the ability to impose tough penalties." In addition to her law degree, Domingo has a master's in developmental psychology. She began her career as a public school teacher, focused on students with behavioral issues and learning delays. Over the years, she crafted a tough love approach, first to help those students and later the juvenile offenders she saw as a judge. But it requires her to project the most intimidating version of herself. "I recognize personally and from my psychological background that you can't make people change. It has to come from them," she says. "And one thing that motivates that desire for change is recognizing that behavior has consequences. Unless someone steps in and says, 'You either stop doing this or you're going to end up incarcerated or a drug addict,' it's not going to happen." That can put her in an uncomfortable position because scaring people straight requires her to be, well, scary. Once, facing a 17-year-old boy accused of first-degree robbery, she had the choice of imposing a lengthy jail cell or diverting him to probation. "My impression was that he was a good kid," she says. "He told me he wanted to be a veterinarian, and I said, 'That's great, but how are you going to do that from prison?'" She wanted to keep him out of jail, but she also needed to make him believe that she'd lock him up in a heartbeat if he slipped up. "So that's what she told him. I said, 'You go to school, and if you don't miss any classes for the rest of the year, I'll reevaluate my decision that you belong in jail.'" She succeeded in scaring the boy, but she also scared his father, who called Domingo to report his son when the teen cut school one day. She wasn't sure how she could keep him out of jail a second time without undermining her credibility and potentially losing the positive influence she had. When the teen came back to court, he admitted that he had skipped class, which gave Domingo an out. She rewarded his honesty with a lesser penalty. Instead of sending him to jail, she had him spend every day of spring break in court with her as she adjudicated adult crimes, doling out the kind of prison time that could have been in his future. The young man finished the school year, stayed out of jail, and even wrote a poem about his judge. "Some people call her mean. Some people can see her as a friend. Your Honor, you have made me bloom." The scared and the scary. Some traits may be universally intimidating, but we're not all equally affected by them. Some of us are more easily intimidated than others, and some of the characteristics we find most daunting might not even rattle the next guy. Our strongest feelings of intimidation often correspond to our own insecurities, says clinical psychologist Carla Marie Manley, the author of the book Joy from Fear. If we're afraid we're not smart enough, we may find someone with an advanced degree especially intimidating. If we worry that other people are constantly judging us, we may feel threatened when we meet a psychologist, as many people are. It goes to the core of our self-esteem, Manley explains, and sets us up for toxic comparisons that can spark feelings of inadequacy if we pride ourselves on our looks or athletic ability. Then when we meet someone with better looking or more athletic, that uncomfortable feeling can arise. Some people set out to intimidate us, however, while others never mean to. The trouble is that we feel the same in either situation. To tell the bullies from the well-intentioned people who just happen to push our buttons, we have to get past our instinctive threat response and analyze each interaction logically. But it gets trickier, Manley says, because we're intimidated by people who remind us of someone who hurt us in the past. It's hard to overcome the emotional power of that reaction, especially because we aren't always conscious of it. I have certainly experienced being intimidated by very specific people, particularly those who remind me of a highly aggressive person from my youth, Manley says. Even as a psychologist, I had to do quite a bit of self-work in order to not be triggered by every male who seemed to have these same characteristics. Once you become aware of your triggers and old patterns, you can practice becoming more discriminating and less reactive over time. Exuding power. The antidote to all forms of intimidation is self-esteem, Manley says. Strong self-esteem doesn't rely on external attributes. It comes from knowing that you've overcome challenges with strength, courage, and dignity, and that you have a moral compass that guides you. The secret is, nobody's better than you. We're all human. Developing stronger self-esteem not only makes us less easily intimidated, but less intimidating as well, since those of us who feel the most vulnerable can also be the most menacing. That's something Liz Myers knows firsthand. As a child growing up in an abusive environment, she developed a tough exterior and a brazen personality to protect herself. It was a shock when she first realized that her defensive ferocity evoked fear in others, even adults. Inside, I felt so minimal, but I had to project something else, she says. When you internalize that abuse, it becomes part of your personality to be defensive and fearful. I did what I had to do to keep people away. It took most of her 20s, she says, to untangle her reactive aggression from an empowering assertiveness. True assertiveness doesn't make other people afraid of you, or it shouldn't. Today, Myers is 6 feet tall, heavily tattooed, and naturally loud, so she still scares people, but not the way she used to. People are influenced just by my physical space, combining with the fact that I have exactly zero need for small talk and I don't have a problem asserting my opinion. Myers works for a social service agency in Connecticut, finding housing and support for people who are chronically homeless and often challenged by mental illness and addiction. Her clients aren't usually cowed by her forceful presence or her tattoos. I feel like it makes me more human to them, she says, because of my appearance and my direct communication style, and because I was raised with people who had the same challenges. The trouble arises when she has to navigate bureaucracy on her client's behalf and has to adapt to avoid rubbing someone the wrong way. I don't change who I am, Myers says. I just adjust the volume. Sometimes, though, being a little scary can be beneficial. I never want anyone to fear me in the visceral sense, like I might hurt them, she adds, but it serves me well to have an intimidating presence, and it serves my clients. For people on the margins, out of sight, out of mind, and largely voiceless, Myers provides a bullhorn. I can't hide and I can't blend in. I just have to own it. Misreading introverts. Introverts can have an especially hard time realizing when they're sending intimidating signals. At 4'11", Jessica O'Day, a Connecticut attorney, doesn't take up a lot of space in the courtroom, and she doesn't have a loud voice or a brash personality. So she's been surprised to hear, a number of times, usually from much taller male attorneys, that she comes across as intimidating. I'm very introverted, shy unless I know you, and terrified of public speaking, and I chose to be a litigation attorney. Oh, the irony, she laughs. I'm constantly questioning my own abilities. Law school made me feel like I'm the stupidest person alive. That's not how others see her, though, and Audet's self-doubts may contribute to her intimidating presence. Too unsure of herself to wing it in the courtroom, she prepares diligently for each case, which has earned her a reputation for exacting thoroughness. At the same time, her natural introversion can translate as standoffishness. Then there was a time she made a witness cry on the stand. That was only because she was lying, Audet explains. You can't lie in court. I told her that. Because introverts sometimes come across as emotionally distant, others can get the impression that they're holding something back, which rings an internal alarm. We have this automatic, intuitive sense that there's something off here when words and emotional signals seem misaligned, says Marks, a University College London. It doesn't allow people to connect on that human level. Still, despite the faith we put in our gut instincts when sizing someone up, those hunches are often unreliable. First impressions are far less accurate than some would have you believe, says psychologist Scott Highhouse of Bowling Green State University. Although some social psychological research suggests we can make accurate assessments based on a brief moment of observation or thin slicing that holds true only if we are able to compile the assessments of multiple observers, Highhouse explains. At the individual level, which is what we care about, thin slices have minimal accuracy for predicting behavior. Sociopaths, after all, excel at winning people over, and while introverts may fumble first impressions, they tend to be more trustworthy than others in the long run. Managing expectations. Why don't people realize they are intimidating? Studies show that nearly all of us believe we're self-aware, able to discern, for example, if we appear threatening or standoffish. But only 10 to 15% of us actually are, according to organizational psychologist Tasha Urich. And those at the top of a particular social hierarchy may be especially out of touch with how they're perceived. No one will tell them. Most people think they're really approachable, says Mark Bellino, a management professor at the University of Oklahoma. But you don't know how you're coming across. You have to ask. That's why he urges business leaders to cultivate an atmosphere in which people can give constructive criticism freely and to ask for feedback often. Even subtle reminders of a power differential can make others anxious. If you're a supervisor sitting behind a desk, the desk itself can create an intimidating presence, Bellino says. To counteract that, if you're talking to an employee, come around the desk and sit next to them, or have the meeting in their office instead, or outside of the office to de-emphasize that hierarchical relationship. Terrell Bellin, an IT manager at the New York City Public Library, recently discovered how climbing the career ladder made him more intimidating. Earlier this year, he was promoted to a higher-level management position overseeing 3 regional managers and 15 technicians. Soon after, he interviewed candidates for an open technician spot and noticed that many seemed flustered. One couldn't remember the word gigabyte. The candidate he ultimately hired seemed sure of himself in the interview, but when Bellin called to offer him the job, the man was shocked. He said, "I didn't think I was going to get the job. I've never been more nervous on a job interview." Bellin was shocked, too. He'd had no idea he was a scary interviewer. He worked his way up from the library ground floor. His first job at age 15 was as a page returning books to shelves, and still thinks of himself as more blue-collar than white-collar. "I think I'm a sweetheart, but when I'm sitting across from you in my suit and tapping my pen or whatever, I can come across as very serious," he now realizes. It's not just an issue in job interviews. Colleagues who meet him as a manager and never knew the 15-year-old page he sometimes still feels like can find himself closed off. "I've had people say, 'I didn't like you at first. When I saw you walking down the hall, you seemed like you couldn't be bothered,'" he says. "I guess you have to get past that invisible wall that I'm not always aware of." Such blind spots can carry real costs in the workplace, Bellino says. If employees are intimidated by their supervisors, they may not alert them to problems they're having on key projects, and companies could eventually lose talented workers who feel anxious on the job. The fact that coveted management attributes like competence and charisma can be intimidating makes the issue even more complicated. Being extremely morally upright can discomfort others as well. "I've known people who are incredibly upstanding and ethical," Bellino says, "and I sometimes find myself more nervous around them and cautious about what I say. I'm afraid I might accidentally curse or do something they could find inappropriate." To counteract this, Bellino suggests that managers, or anyone who comes to realize they intimidate, inject humility and humanity into their interactions whenever possible. Making a mistake is perhaps the most human thing we can do, and research on the pratfall effect shows that screwing up tends to make us more likable. In one study, when people perceived as highly competent spilled coffee on themselves, it didn't diminish people's perception of their competence, but it did make others like them more. This is an article titled "The Intimidation Factor" by Jennifer Latson. She is a science writer and author of the book "The Boy Who Loved Too Much." Next is an article by Sam Keen titled "She Woke Up with a French Accent." People who suffer from foreign accent syndrome, FAS, which is most often caused by a stroke or brain lesion, suddenly sounds as if their native language is a second tongue. The pain felled her like an axe to the skull. A moment after it hit, Ellen Spencer crumpled to her knees, unable to move. It was a gloomy Monday during a rain-soaked week in Indianapolis, and Spencer, then a 47-year-old graphic designer, had been feeling odd all day. "I was sitting at the computer doing a project, and I felt the tip of my chin go numb. I thought, 'This is weird.' As the day progressed, the numbness spread to her lips, then her nose, cheek, eyebrow, and forehead. It was exactly as if I'd gotten a lidocaine shot from the dentist. At 8:30 p.m., she was doing dishes at the sink when something snapped. I was driven to my knees as if someone had put an axe through the back of my head, right at the base of the skull. After gathering her strength, she more or less crawled upstairs to bed and woke her husband. Incredibly, she decided to sleep the pain off and call her doctor if she didn't feel better the next morning. She awoke at 7:30 a.m. with an excruciating headache and began counting down the minutes until the nearby clinic opened. Even scarier, the numbness had spread over my right shoulder into my upper arm and armpit. I was afraid, she says. There were no openings at the clinic, so they sent her to the emergency room. A long, frustrating day of tests followed. Meanwhile, the numbness continued to spread over her right side, and she worried that it might overtake her lungs. At one point, she recalls, my husband asked, "What did they give you?" He thought the hospital had medicated her. But she answered, "Nothing, only saline. Why?" He replied, "Your speech is slurring as if they'd given you something." The cause of her numbness and pain was, and still remains, a mystery, as her tests were inconclusive, though she believes she suffered a microbleed too subtle to show up on brain scans. Spencer returned home in the late afternoon and crashed. Her husband brought her dinner a few hours later, but she didn't stir. In fact, she slept for 16 hours. Her husband had to work the next morning, so she woke up to find herself alone in the house. The numbness and pain persisted, but she could at least drag herself to the bathroom. On the way, she muttered something to Spirit, her Jack Russell Terrier. It was so mundane she had no recollection of what she had said. It was something like, "Hey girl, are you ready to go downstairs?" But while she doesn't recall exactly what she said, the way she said it is permanently seared into her memory, because the voice that emerged from her mouth wasn't hers. It sounded bizarre, alien, as if she had an accent. Still foggy, she staggered to a mirror and spoke again, confirming that, yes, the strange voice was coming from her own mouth. Frightened, she kept talking out loud to herself in Spirit, trying to fix the problem. She muttered, "I sound weird," except it came out as, "I sound word." She tried the phrase once more and again butchered it. Thinking she could swap in another word, she said, "I'll just try something different." But that came out sounding wrong, too. It sounded French. Différent. She also tried another remark. "That's strange." Again, it sounded French. Strange. She broke down crying. Something was desperately wrong. She'd been born and raised in Indiana and had spoken with a flat Midwestern inflection her whole life. Now, unaccountably, she had a foreign accent. Today, 10 years later, she still has this accent. After a little online research, Spencer realized she'd developed a rare neurological disorder called foreign accent syndrome. FAS is most commonly caused by a stroke or brain lesion. While doctors have never figured out what caused her accent shift, it did leave her with several linguistic quirks. For instance, she has trouble pronouncing the letters TH. Mother and father become mutter and fodder. She also chops up words in unusual ways. "I call it my doctor," and "I can't be quite comfortable." Overall, Spencer describes her accent as a blend of French, Dutch, and German, with hard consonants like South African or Caribbean. Definitely not my normal Midwest Indiana voice. Because language is so closely tied to our sense of self and sense of belonging to a community, FAS can be devastating. It can also shatter friendships and drive spouses away. Voices are part of our identity, a powerful part, says Sheila Blumstein, a professor emerita of linguistics at Brown University who studies FAS. So imagine if that changes. You wake up and you don't sound like you anymore. But while the way she speaks has attracted the most attention, Spencer says that FAS has affected other capabilities as well. She has trouble planning tasks and remembering things, and she's constantly monitoring her own speech to dodge certain words. It's exhausting. Well-meaning people, she says, sometimes comment that they would love to have a French accent. She isn't so sure. "Be careful what you wish for," she replies. A jumble of vowels. In many ways, Spencer is a typical FAS patient. Although the syndrome can emerge in children as young as 7, one academic review found that the average age of onset is 48. It's also more common among women. In one collection of cases, 26 of the 27 patients were female. Women are more likely to seek medical treatment in general, so some scientists speculate that FAS simply comes to light more often in them. In addition, during her initial incident, Spencer felt numbness on her right side, which is controlled by the brain's left hemisphere. FAS patients usually suffer brain damage on the left side, which dominates speech in most people. Also, patients typically can't speak the language associated with their accents. Spencer's accent is regularly mistaken for French or German, but as she often tells people, I don't parlez-vous and I don't sprechen Sie Deutsch. FAS can affect several different aspects of speech. The most obvious shifts involve sound. Sheet becomes seat, or ship becomes sheep. Sometimes people pronounce silent letters or add unnecessary syllables reminiscent of Pig Latin. Standing becomes standing, or picture becomes pictar. The rhythm and melody of patient speech, the prosody, can also be disrupted. Their pitch might rise where you'd expect it to fall or vice versa, or they might stress the wrong syllables. Sometimes people resort to telegraphic speech, eliminating articles or predispositions, or they pause too often, as if struggling to come up with the next word. A patient's new accent isn't connected to any particular foreign language. It's more of a hodgepodge accent. And despite the shifts in sound and rhythm, people with FAS aren't speaking pidgin. They can still speak fluently in their native tongue and make themselves understood. Nor are they slurring words or stumbling over syllables the way someone with severe speech difficulties would. No natural language contains those features, and a listener would instantly recognize that something was wrong neurologically. FAS speech, in contrast, is only subtly different, and it contains a suite of sounds and rhythms that could plausibly belong to a real language. It just happens not to any particular natural language, Blumstein says. Instead, it's a jumble, with vowels you might hear in native French speakers, rhythms associated with Italian, pitches reminiscent of Chinese, and so on. For these reasons, FAS speech is a true accent, but it contains enough quirks and distortions that our brains classify it as somehow foreign. In fact, different people often interpret the same accent in different ways. In Boston, in the 1980s, Blumstein met her first FAS patient at a hospital during a case presentation with psychologist and neurologist. Afterward, all the health professionals wondered, what accent does she have? Blumstein is a linguist by training, and she found it interesting that some people in the room thought the patient sounded German, while others thought she sounded Russian or French. Yet, as far as sound structure is concerned, those languages are not related. It intrigued me, says Blumstein. What are we really hearing? In truth, the listener's background actually influences what they perceive, Blumstein adds. We concluded the accent is really in the ears of the beholder. That heterogeneity, along with its rarity, has made FAS difficult to study systematically. You get one patient, and then maybe 6 years later you get another patient, and then another one 10 years later, Blumstein says. And because different researchers use different methods and ask different questions, large-scale analysis hasn't been possible. Jack Riles, a linguist at the University of Central Florida who is one of the world's leading experts on FAS, even argues that the term foreign accent syndrome might be a misnomer. He recently co-edited a book of case studies called Foreign Accent Syndromers, plural, to emphasize the wide variety of types he's encountered. The choreography of speech. Scientists disagree about what causes foreign accent syndromes, and it's possible that different types have different causes. But the root of most cases seems to be found in the mouth and throat. Speaking a word aloud requires two steps: planning, which takes place in the brain, and execution, which involves moving the teeth, tongue, lips, lungs, and voice box in a coordinated way. Neurological speech problems can arise from either step, but execution seems to be the culprit with FAS. As evidence, Blumstein notes that people with difficulties in executive function often make characteristic mistakes, like saying "dappy haze" instead of "happy days." Her FAS patients never made those oral typos. More specifically, some scientists have traced the execution problems to motor articulation. Speaking aloud requires contorting the mouth and throat to alter the flow of air streaming through. The brain controls these delicate movements, and brain damage can affect the ability to choreograph them. Similarly, some people with brain damage struggle to produce the proper tension in their vocal apparatus. All these changes affect the sounds that emerge from a person's airways, with distorted speech as the result. Strokes remain the most common trigger for FAS, but scientists also have linked it to multiple sclerosis, infections, withdrawal from Parkinson's drugs, electrocution, schizophrenia, brain tumors, and neurotoxicity from, of all things, spider bites. Other cases might not involve brain lesions at all. Laura McWhirter, a neuropsychologist at the University of Edinburgh, traces some cases of FAS to what are called functional neurological disorders. In explaining what those are, she makes an analogy with computers. Computers can crash because of hardware problems, software problems, or some combination. Similarly, neurological disorders can arise from brain lesions, akin to hardware, faulty signal processing within the brain, software, or a combination of both. With functional FAS, McWhirter notes, many patients are dealing with jaw injuries or have recently undergone dental or oral surgery. As a result, there's unusual extrasensory feedback from the mouth, she says. But in some people, this attention backfires, and their speech goes awry. Intriguingly, if articulation problems in effortful speech are, in fact, the root of FAS, then it's possible that not all accents are equally likely to emerge. FAS appears worldwide and can cause a dizzying array of perceived accent and dialect shifts, from Japanese to Korean, Spanish to Hungarian, Dutch to Turkish, Bronx to Irish, Georgian to Cajun, among other combinations. But according to one preliminary survey of cases from the Netherlands, most FAS patients start off speaking languages like English or Dutch and acquire accents associated with speakers of Romance, Eastern Europe, or tonal languages such as Chinese. Those latter languages, the Dutch scientists argue, require more muscular effort and breath force, meaning the throat and lungs have to work harder. And if someone suffers an injury that affects their articulation, they might compensate, consciously or not, by forcing their vocal apparatus to work more. However, neither Riles or Bloomstein subscribe to this theory. But if that theory does prove true, it would be much more likely for, say, a native English speaker to acquire a faux French or Chinese accent than for the inverse to happen. There's an article titled She Woke Up with a French Accent by Sam Keane. He is the author of many books, including The Bastard Brigade and Caesar's Last Breath. That's all the time we have for tonight's show, Mindscapes. Thank you for tuning in. This is Corey Dunkirk, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on our website, sunsounds.org. On the left side, click on the Broadcast Info and Audio tab. Then, select the On Demand podcast. From there, you can listen to this show or any other shows read by volunteers. I invite you to join me next week for a new and informative program. Have an awesome week, and stay tuned for Sun Sounds of Arizona.